this will be recorded, and we'll send you the link so you can download it. The title of the talk is The Joyfulness of Life That Includes the Difficult Memories. And I want to reflect a little bit on the issue of memory and how we can look at it from the point of view of the Dharma and Buddhist psychology a little bit. And that's how I will start. Of course, we need memory to function. We need memory to be a person, to be a healthy person. We need to know that a bus on the road is a bit of a dangerous thing. And we have to remember that. And our parents tell us when we're a few years old, be careful when crossing the road. And that's fine, except that the difficult memories and the painful ones, they tend to stick and they tend to take a lot of place in the consciousness. They tend to, we tend to identify with them, we tend to build ourself around them. We give them weight and importance. Because the self is challenged by these painful experiences, and the self takes it on and tries to work it out, and they sit there. So we actually build ourselves a lot from these difficult memories, and we find ourselves often quite wounded with scars from the difficult experiences we had in our life, and they're not always clear and they're not always obvious to us, and we sometimes find ourselves kind of circling around our pain, our wounds, like a moth around a fire or a candle, and we're not quite sure where they are, but they work in us. We are built ourselves from often around them, and it really they act unconsciously. They act below the level of the radar very often. We just don't know that they're there, but we act from them. And I think all of us last night also expressed in some way or other this understanding. It's something we all understand, but it's not necessarily so easy to really locate where these difficult memories are, how they are, what they're doing to us. And anxiety is a very good example. I mean, my own parents, as Adele and I grew up, were refugees from Germany and had losses in the family through the Holocaust. And the anxiety that goes into life, and it becomes part of life. And then it goes to the next generation, and the next generation have to deal with difficulty or anxiety or fear that is really not very clear. It just comes automatically. It's a bit like this image of the elephant in the room. And a big story like the Holocaust becomes like the elephant in the room, that everyone is kind of behaving differently because there's an elephant in the room, but no one is actually saying, there's an elephant sitting right in the middle of this room, and you can't go on with business as usual. You can't. But people just are not able to actually pay attention together and say, yes, there's an elephant in the room, look at it. Instead, they kind of go around it and they act as if it wasn't there. And then you lose a lot of your life through this dance that you're doing to avoid the elephant. And we discussed this in it last night a little bit in the context of the life in Israel, which is creating from the Holocaust quite an icon, and it's inside the culture, the elephant in the room that is doing things to the culture, creating, for example, very simply, a constant narrative, we are victims. We are victims is a narrative that's passing generation after generation after generation, and it has, in a way, toxic consequences, because there is a lack of inner peace and steadiness and inner quiet and love of life, because always there is the sense, well, where's the next threat coming from? And where's the next problem coming from? So the victim becomes a consciousness, and it goes inside the culture, even of the, or the, shall we say, the national consciousness. And I think the opposite but similar movement in Germany, and we're joined in this by this, we're together. There isn't any more in that sense Israelis and Germans. It's, we are joined in this one movement of trying to acting out, and with this elephant in the room that we can't actually see and we can't actually deal with, and it's big and it's sitting there. I just have to tell a small story about, I'm not going to go into the kind of Israeli politics or anything right now, but just a very small story which is very touching. My wife for some years has been working with elderly Arabs and Jews in the north, in the north of Israel, and in a way bringing Palestinian elderly Arabs into the education system for the elderly, which used to be really just for the Jewish population in the area that we were in. And she brought in the elderly Arab Palestinian groups to into the system of education classes, groups, etc., for the elderly. And one time she took them to Holocaust museum in the north of Israel called Lochamei Hagetzot. And she brought 50 elderly Arab men and women to tour this Holocaust museum. And they went on the tour and they saw models of concentration camps and so on. And then afterwards there was a sharing together. And they said, we never realized how much the Jews suffered in Europe. And this does explain to us a lot. But why did you need to build your Holocaust museum on our olive trees? And it's like, there is in one sort of sentence, in a way encapsulating the whole way that this thing moves on, generation after generation, doing it, chains of having chains of results. So we're faced with this, and we're faced with this sense of the pain creating results that are under the radar, and then they become passed from generation to generation, and they become automatic behaviors, and so on. So in Buddhist psychology, memory is a form, is called a sankhara. And I have a picture here. This is instead of PowerPoint presentation. I have a picture here of sankhara. It's the image of the potter. Potter that is making a ceramic bowl. And it's in the wheel of life, sankhara is given the image of the potter. That is construction. So sankhara is construction, And memories are constructions in the mind. Another way to look at them are engravings. They're engraved into the consciousness, like lines in the consciousness. I mean, it's very similar to Western neuroscience that would say that the patterns that we see that allow us to recognize a tree are networks of neurons in the brain, and they are networks called a tree, or networks called a person, or networks called Stephen. And so these are the engravings or constructions in the mind, and there's nothing wrong with them except that we believe them to be true. And that's the problem. We believe them to be the truth, that every one of the constructions that are constructed in the mind is the truth, is the way it is a fact. And how can it be a fact if it's a construction in the brain? Because another construction would be just different. So where is the truth of it? It's not, in other words, out there as a fact. It's in here as a construction in the brain. I remember one of the strongest images I have is about this, is reading when I was very young. I used to love the Jungle Book. And I love the Jungle Book because the hero, Mowgli, Rudyard Kipling's Jungle Book, and maybe you know it or you don't know it, but he grew up with parents as wolves. So he thought he was a wolf. But he had a human body, but no one told him he was a human. So he entirely thought he was a wolf. For him, the networks in the brain say, wolf. I am a wolf. And it's true for him, and he entirely true. So therefore, where is the truth? If, you know, your parents are wolves, you think you're a wolf. If your parents are humans, you think you're a, your parents, where is the truth? So this sense of building a fictional self and building a fictional world, you could say virtual world, which we then think is the absolute truth, is described in the Buddhist psychology as vidya, or ignorance. And from there comes the chain of attachments to me and the world. The world is like it is. And it's in this territory that we suffer from the attachments to narratives that give us pain, because we think they're true. And something in us has made a construction called, this is the way it is. And the obvious example is, you know, I am a victim. Who says you're a victim? It's a sankhara, it's a construction, which just passes on, because then you look for proof that you are a victim. And you'll find it. And they go, well, of course. Because it's a view. But it's only a view. It's only a story. It's not a reality. It's engraved in the neural networks. And there is neuronal plasticity. The networks can be changed. And we're doing it every time we sit and practice. Yesterday I was talking about the white page. Just by being in the white page of our life, saying, what's important? My breath is important. So those constructions become less true or less solid. And that's why we practice. I think Heidegger said one time, this is what I read, that we forget 99.9% of everything that we experience. We are left with in memory 0.01% or some very tiny number of experiences that we, and that's what we remember. But that's what we call reality. That our reality is built from the 0.001% of just those things we remember. We call it real. So, but we remember those things that are painful very often, and so we call that real. So what's the good news in Buddhist psychology is that the memory, when it arises in our consciousness as an experience, is described as one of the six senses. So there's five senses, which are sense organs: the eye, the ear, and the nose, and the touch, and the taste, and the hearing, and what arises as thought in the mind is another sense. So the mind is like a sense organ, like the eye. And so memories are indeed engraved, but when we experience them, they come up as a bird, like a bird sound in the trees. Conditions, for example, we recognize something outside and this gives us a memory. When that memory comes up because of conditions, we remember something. The consciousness receives it just like it receives a sound outside. So in the experience of our moment by moment, memory is also experienced as something very dynamic that comes and goes. It may be down there engraved, but in our moment by moment experience, it comes and it goes freely. And it's very dynamic. And the Buddha said it's like a line drawn on water that just vanishes. The line has no trace or no track. If we see it really as it is, every experience, the bird, beautiful sound, and the next second it's gone. And where is it gone? And what's left of it? And the same with the experience even of sankhara. When we experience them in the moment, it comes and it goes. And this is the good news, because it means that when we really are in the present experience of things, we see that everything is much more dynamic, and we don't need to be totally believing in these constructions, because when we really look at the experience of them, they come and they go like a bird song, like a smell, like a taste of food, like a thought that we don't have much control over. It just comes and goes, and because of that, painful experiences, actually in the present moment, when they arise naturally, we can cry. If we need to cry, we can cry and move on. And they pass, if we watch them, they pass on. So in many ways, if we look at the actual expression of memory, we actually don't need to be busy with it. In the real world, we just don't need to be busy with the memories, because our actual experience of them, if we look carefully, is of something that comes and goes constantly and freely. We tend not to do that. We tend to hold it. We tend then to be busy with it, or we tend to deny it, or we tend to work on it. Or like I say, the elephant in the room, we tend to sort of dance around the elephant sitting in the room, and just, especially as a group, we all don't want to talk about it. But actually, if we pay attention, the experiences come and go like everything else. And we don't need to be part of this chain of, for example, being a victim, or being a victimizer, or working with it, or denying it, or exaggerating it, or holding on to it, or depending on it, because this is being busy with it, and it doesn't need that. If we watch carefully, it doesn't need it. It's what happens to us. We tend to do it, but actually, if we open our eyes, we see, oh, there's an elephant in the room. Oh, okay. Here you are. I see you. You have nice eyelashes. You have a nice trunk. I see you when you're here in the room, and when I go out of the room, I don't see you. So there is an innate freedom that we have, which we often forget and we often don't pay enough attention to, but we have a very big freedom to be with things that come up in a natural way and watch that even the most solid seeming sankharas or constructions are not really solid at all if we look at them directly. They are experiences that come and go like everything else. And this way the scars are healed, because we don't give them authority on us. We see them as they really are. It brings them back into life. They become less personal, less a matter of owned, that they're mine, that we build a self around them. If we really look at them, they're experiences that come and go. We do not need to build a self around them, even the most painful experiences. So I want to give an example of how this feels like. And it's a really extraordinary thing that just before I came, like the day before I got on the plane, someone gave me this book, which I lent to them about 8 years ago. It's the diaries of Etty Hillesum, that many of you may know of this book. Extraordinary diary of a woman living at the time, a Dutch woman living at the time of the German occupation, the Nazi occupation of Holland. But I was quite amazed that this was my book, and she gave it back to me the day before I flew here, and it was the perfect book that just dropped into my hand to give you some quotations of what it feels like not to be controlled by these sankharas of constructions around difficulty. I want to give you very, very powerful experiences and that she had of being free in the middle of the most difficult experiences, because of her ability just to see life as it is in the middle of difficulty. I'll give you some of her quotations. I went to bed early last night, and from my bed I stared out through the large open window, and it was once more as if life, with all its mysteries, was close to me, as if I could touch it. I had the feeling that I was resting against the naked breast of life, and could feel her gentle and regular heartbeat. I felt safe and protected. And I thought, how strange. It's wartime. There are concentration camps. I can say of so many of the houses I pass, here the son has been thrown into prison. There the father has been taken hostage. An 18-year-old boy in that house over there has been sentenced to death, and these streets and houses are all so close to my own. I know how very nervous people are. I know about the mounting human suffering. I know the persecution and oppression, and the impotent fury and the terrible sadism. I know it, and yet At unguarded moments, when left to myself, I suddenly lie against the naked breast of life, and her arms round me are so gentle and so protective, and my own heartbeat is difficult to describe, so slow and so regular and so soft, almost muffled, but so constant, as if it would never stop. Most of us don't understand the art of suffering and experience a thousand fears instead. We cease to be alive being full of fear and bitterness and hatred and despair. And God knows it's only too easy to understand why. But when we are deprived of our lives, are we really deprived of so much? We have to accept death as part of life. And don't we live an entire life, each one of our days? And does it really matter if we live a few days more or less? I am in Poland every day, on the battlefields, if that's what one can call them. I see visions of poisonous smoke. I am with the hungry, with the ill-treated and the dying every day. But I am also with the jasmine flower and with that piece of sky beyond my window. There is room for everything in a single life. Does that mean I'm never sad? That I never rebel? I always give in? No, far from it. I believe that I know and share the many sorrows and sad circumstances that a human being can experience. But I do not cling to them. I do not prolong such moments of agony. They pass through me like life itself, as a broad, eternal stream. They become part of that stream, and life continues. Give your sorrow all the space and shelter in yourself that is its due, that it needs. For if everyone bears his grief honestly and courageously, the sorrow that now fills the world will become less. But if you do not clear a decent shelter for your sorrow and instead reserve most of the space inside you for hatred and for anger, from which new sorrows will be born for others, it will never cease in this world and will multiply. If you have given sorrow the space its gentle origins demand, then you may truly say, life is beautiful and so rich. So, how are we to practice with this? What's the lesson for us? What do we do to be like Etty Hillerson? Fundamentally, it is about knowing things as they come and as they go, and being very, very open and clear about experiences as they come, and very clear about experiences as they go. If we do this, we find we actually don't need to do anything with them. We don't need to suppress them, to look for them, to encourage them, to deny them, to project them onto other people, to be busy with them. They become our rich life, just as Etty said. They're just the stories that arise and pass away as part of our rich life. And they need us to be, to move from identification to experience. When we identify, we build a self, we construct self. And with the self becomes lots and lots of thinking, proliferation of thought about me and my and what I need and what I am and who I am and what, how difficult it is, and all the stories. The mind turns around very, very intensely, supporting the identification. But we don't need to go there. We can experience things, however difficult, just as they are, as the shape of things, the shape of things as they are, including our memory. So we don't need to wipe out our memory, we don't need to deny it, we don't need to ignore it. We can be with the memory as experience when it comes up in a very natural way and when it goes. In other words, we have a shape, because I'm Stephen and I'm shaped like this. I'm constantly reminded of this because I'm living in the middle of lots of olive trees, and the olive trees have an amazing shape. Their trunk is very twisted, and they carry with them everything that's happened to them, the olive tree. So if a branch has been cut, you see that it makes a shape in the trunk, and if there's been period of dry weather, the leaves go and the shape changes, and the tree responds to conditions with a certain shape, and that's, if you like, its memory. Well, the tree doesn't have a problem with that. There's no reason why we should have a problem with that either. We can be like the olive tree. We just have a shape. Construction. Sankara. There's nothing wrong with sankara, as I said before. It's just shape. The problem is we don't need to turn around it all the time and be it and be busy with it and project it and regard it as absolute truth. But shaping happens. It's okay. Embodiment happens. We've given a body and we arrive in this world. Body's got a shape. It's okay. It's just what it is. If we kind of go there, we don't really then need to spend our life trying to fix ourselves, which we tend to do. There's really nothing to be fixed. It's the shape that we become embodied in this moment. The shape of our memory creates us as we are. That's this moment, this day, this present moment. It has a, you know, we arrive in it in a certain shape. There's nothing in a sense to be fixed. Stories are just stories. Narratives are just narratives. Acknowledging, just like I said, a story when it comes up is like a sound of a bird passing by. It's experienced in the present moment as a sense, arising and passing. If we really keep with that, slowly, slowly, these painful, the painful busyness, the projection, the holding on to the painful, to the scars, will dissolve. The scars will be brought back into life. Life is now. The scars are shapes. They don't need to rule us. Life is dynamic and it's now. And this way we bring life into the wounds or the scars of our past. A difficult experience can come up just like a unpleasant visitor in the present moment. Like I say, we can cry tears and then the next minute we can laugh. It's not about forgetting. What I'm saying is the opposite of forgetting. Because very often with especially with the icon, the social icon of the Holocaust, people say we mustn't forget, mustn't forget, mustn't forget. So it's being held on to. Of course we mustn't forget. We're not talking about forgetting. We're talking about experiencing it, but experiencing it as and when and how it comes up to us in the present moment, as an experience in the present that we touches us and moves on. Of course we don't want to forget, but we don't want to be busy with it, because it just doesn't help us. It just makes us, like I say, a moth around the flame. So we know a painful experience when it is painful. We know that pain exists and suffering exists for us. It's the first noble truth of the Buddha. We know the suffering is not personal. It is part of the experience of all embodied beings, human or otherwise. And we just allow it to be what it is. There is a moment of a suffering, and it is nested in, just like Etty said, the whole container of a big life. So that the practice for us is mostly there, is mostly allowing in the present the scars to express themselves if they want to express themselves, and just seeing them as lived experience. And this brings them up, brings them to life. At the same time, we shouldn't force it. We shouldn't try, again, to fix it. We shouldn't push ourselves for this kind of thing. I have, in some of the retreats that I've been teaching in Israel, we've had people that have actually been in the concentration camps, elderly people. I had once, for some years, I was with groups of elderly people in the north of Israel, in a kind of college for the elderly, and quite a few of them had been in the camps in Europe, and one particular man said, and they were really, really loved meditation. They loved it because it was kind of, like I said, the white paper, but just the sense of inner peace and quiet. One woman said, oh, I don't have to worry about being a 70-year-old person with arthritis and grandchildren that really annoy me. I'm just breathing. It's all so simple. I don't need anything. I just breathe. And it's such a relief. But one man, I remember, said, I am busy. I can be with any pain, but I will not touch the pain of my childhood or my younger days in Auschwitz. This is outside the territory of my meditation practice. And I said to him, that's absolutely your wisdom. Because we can't take it all at once. We can't push ourselves. We can't force things. He was very clear how far he could go and how far he could not go. Just as we are, if we have a pain in the body, we know our wisdom will tell us, wait a minute, that's enough. Now I'm moving my body. I've had enough. I'm not here to suffer too much. So there's enough suffering in life. Don't need to add to it. So it's his wisdom. But he was intuitive enough to realize that the more he sat and practiced mindful awareness, the more the suffering of his life was reduced, was seen, was met honestly as a visitor that comes and goes. And he just said, in a way, I'm not ready for that one. That's too big for me, which is really fine. So we don't want to force it. We need to use our wisdom here and our understanding and And it does need sometimes some help, and perhaps this retreat is an example of that. It needs perhaps us to say, yeah, I'm going to make some effort. I'm going to make an intention to work with this material, to dissolve a little bit the sankharas. It sometimes needs intention, effort, it needs practice, it needs direction. It's why basically we're going to visit the camp tomorrow. Not because we all have to visit camp, because it's a good thing to visit the camp. It's simply because it's helpful as an intention to give us a framework for this inner work. It's just a helpful act to allow this inner work to happen, as this retreat is. It stimulates the inner work that we need to do. The beautiful word that is often used in the suttas, in the Buddhist suttas, is that when you see an attachment for what it really is, which is attachment, for example, that you really believe in your story, and all of a sudden you realize it's just a story and not the absolute truth. The word that is often used is disenchantment, that there is a kind of a spell and the spell is broken, that we were under a spell. An attachment is a bit like that. We're under the spell of believing this story, for example, I am the victim, to be the absolute truth. And it's like as if there's a spell, and when we see it for what it is, as a story that comes and goes, the spell is broken, and it's like, I don't know what it is in German, of course, but the word disenchantment. Maybe you could, do you know what it is? There isn't one, huh? Yeah, it seems, because it's like becoming undrunk. It's becoming, sobering up. And when we, it can sometimes feel a little bit of a struggle when we are struggling with a story that's very constructed into the self, and we sometimes feel, I don't know how to deal with this, and we sometimes feel, I actually need this story. And very often that's the self says, I don't know what I'll be without my story. I need my story, even the most painful story. If I lose that, who will I be? And always, when we wake up and become entzauberung, disenchanted, entzauber, we feel relief. There is, when the attachment is broken, we always see relief. How could I have held that heavy, heavy burden before? But sometimes from inside, well, we're still with it. We're attached to it, meaning we think we need it. Like the person in the train, the passenger in the train, that feels he must carry his suitcases. And all of a sudden someone tells him, wait a minute, you can put your suitcases down, let them go, and let the train take you and the suitcases. And when he does that, oh, what a relief. I didn't realise I didn't need to carry my suitcases. And this is, it goes deeper and deeper and deeper. The quotes I read from Iti Hilasam are so inspiring because she let go into life. There was something in her that could really let go into the big space of life because she refused to be burdened with the identifications of suffering and sorrow. She allowed them to talk through her, but it just gave her a bigger sense of being with life. And we, in the world of Dharma practice, we are moving constantly towards less construction, more freedom. You can almost say that Nibbana, awakening, enlightenment, whatever, these big words, but they are, it is, these big words mean being alive and unconstructed, unattached, unclosed, unboxed, without being in a box of our attachments. And so it carries on into the spiritual dimension. We're not just talking about dealing with the scars, we're talking about some fundamental existential freedom. We're talking about continuing with this work, which is the work of liberation. So they're not different. Dealing with our scars, bringing life to them, bringing melting the attachments and the constructions, it keeps going. It touches the difficult places and it just keeps going. It can be helped by emotional work. There are many, many tools and directions in the Dharma. I mean, the Dharma teaching is huge. We can also find help in many different places for this. Compassion is another place of non-attachment, where our heart is open and not attached to my suffering or my neighbor's suffering, but is free to respond and to vibrate with the suffering of all. And again, it moves us away from our sankharas, from our constructions. Compassion is another movement. Forgiveness is another movement. It cleans that, the constructions that hold us. So we can use emotional practice, and we can use mindfulness practice, we can use many different ways of intentions. In the end, we're working with this material here, this being. It's all here. It's not out there. It's here, where the constructions are. It's not in the world. And again, Etty says it very beautifully, life is just life. She says, she describes how she's so close to the heartbeat of life. Life is just life. It brings with it the biggest tragedies and the biggest joys, and it's uncontrollable. The work is here, that we become free, open vessel for this extraordinary life. Thank you. So we'll just take a couple of moments of silence.